Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Usually, when you conceptualize any kind of journey, there's a really clear, indisputable starting point.
Right.
And a definitive destination.
Right. You're here and you want to be over there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You find yourself in one location, you identify a target, and you just sort of plot a trajectory between the two. And the underlying assumption is always linear.
Yeah, we really rely on that.
We do. You abandon ignorance, and through exertion, you eventually achieve wisdom. I mean, you leave a state of suffering, and you arrive at a state of liberation.
It's a profoundly comfortable binary framework, you know, for understanding spiritual or personal progress.
Mm-hmm.
We rely on those dualities to just orient ourselves in the practice.
It gives you a map.
Yeah, exactly. It provides the sense of security to clearly demarcate what we are rejecting and what we're cultivating. If the path is a straight line, you can measure your progress by just looking back at how far you've traveled from the origin.
But, you know, when you begin to study the really vast, luminous architecture of the Mahayana Sutras, that linear map completely dissolves.
It really does.
The straight line just bends into a circle. Because the text we're examining today presents a paradigm where the destination you were desperately seeking is actually composed of the exact same fundamental substance as the place you're trying to escape.
Which requires a complete philosophical paradigm shift from the practitioner. I mean, the instruction is no longer to simply walk faster toward the goal.
Right.
The instruction is actually to stop moving entirely and recognize the nature of the ground that's already beneath your feet.
So welcome to this session of Study and Transmission. We are focusing our attention today on a truly profound canonical text. It's the Noble Great Vehicle Sutra, the seal of engagement in awakening the power of faith.
Yes.
And in its original Sanskrit, for those taking notes, the title is the Aryashra Dhammaladama Fataramutarana Mahayana Sutra.
It's quite a title. And just to contextualize this text historically and categorically, it is To 201 from the Dagae Kangyur, so the Tibetan Buddhist canon.
Right.
It was brought into the Tibetan language in the late 8th or maybe early 9th century, right during the absolute height of the Tibetan Empire's translation efforts.
Which was just a monumental period for the Dharma.
No, absolutely. And the translation was this incredible collaborative effort between the Indian preceptor Surendra Bodhi and the extraordinarily prolific Tibetan translator Yeshe Day.
Wow.
And today, you know, we have the immense privilege of studying it in English due to the meticulous translation work of the Dharmachakra Translation Committee operating under the auspices of the 84,000 Project.
And we really have to pause and just acknowledge that, right? The 84,000 Project's historical significance simply cannot be overstated.
No, it can't.
They are undertaking the monumental task of translating the entire Buddhist canon into modern languages. It ensures that texts like this one, which, you know, might otherwise just remain inaccessible to anyone without classical Tibetan or Sanskrit training, are preserved and actively studied.
Yeah, it's a profound gift to practitioners.
It really is. Now, within the canon itself, this sutra is located in the general sutra section. Yet, its philosophical orientation and some of its stylistic elements suggest a very specific lineage.
Yeah, and early Indian commentators really noticed those affinities as well. The Sutra Samukaya, which is an anthology traditionally attributed to the great philosopher Nagarjuna, actually classifies this text alongside the Buddhavatthasaka family of scriptures.
Which makes total sense when you read it.
The moment you begin reading, the reasons for that classification become completely obvious. I mean, it possesses this breathtaking, almost cosmic scale that completely defies ordinary spatial and temporal logic.
Definitely.
Furthermore, it shares a very similar setting and features the exact same primary interlocutors questioning the Buddha, the great Bodhisattvas Manjushri and Samantabhadra.
So the structure of our teaching today will systematically address the two distinct halves of this sutra. In the initial half, we'll examine the Buddha's discourse, detailing how a bodhisattva basically prepares to enter the first bodhisattva level. And this preparation is entirely rooted in a really rigorous non-dual framework of what the text calls inspiration.
And then a really dramatic shift occurs in the second half. The Buddha actually ceases speaking entirely, and the bodhisattva Samantabhadra takes over the discourse.
It's such a fascinating transition.
It really is. He moves the focus away from the path of training and attempts to describe the ultimate result itself. He utilizes this series of just extraordinary analogies to explain the spontaneous, completely non-conceptual activity of a fully awakened Buddha.
So we basically transition from the mechanics of the cause to the unfathomable reality of the effect.
Exactly.
But before we get into all that, we must first establish the environment where this teaching takes place, because the opening of the sutra does not present, you know, your standard mundane setting.
No, not at all.
The Buddha is described as residing in a luminous mansion. It's a secluded Dharma hermitage. However, this hermitage severely challenges any conventional understanding of physical architecture.
Yeah, it's described as being built with the absolute solidity of Vajra. And in the Buddhist lexicon, you know, Vajra denotes this diamond-like indestructibility. It represents the immutable nature of reality itself.
Right.
And the ground of this mansion is ornamented with flowers and studded with every conceivable type of precious gem. There's a vast ocean of gems displaying myriad colors, intersected by rivers swirling with jeweled flowers.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere itself is permeated with the scent of rare sandalwood.
And the text provides a very specific inventory of the flora raining down upon this scene, right? He lists the Mandarava and Maharaka flowers, divine blue lotuses, and these pristine water lilies. It presents a sensory environment that is flawlessly pure.
It does.
But the crucial detail, the thing the text really insists upon, is the origin of this environment. It states explicitly that this entire magnificent landscape has been emanated entirely by the blessings of the Buddha.
And that is the pivotal detail for us as practitioners. We are not reading about a pre-existing geographical location that the historical Buddha just happened to walk into and decided to use as a teaching venue.
Right. He didn't just rent a nice hall.
Exactly. This environment is an active manifestation of his awakened state. The environment itself is pedagogical. It is a direct reflection of the boundless merit and the pure perception of a fully awakened mind.
Which really sets the stage.
It does. Before a single word of doctrine is even spoken, the environment establishes that we are entering a space that will demand a complete reevaluation of how reality is perceived and constructed.
And sitting on a lion throne at the absolute center of this emanated reality is the Blessed One. The descriptive language applied to the Buddha here is equally challenging for our ordinary minds. He's described as possessing a non-conceptual body, a body that pervades every universe and is as limitless as the realm of phenomena.
It's just massive.
It is. And he is surrounded by an ocean of bodhisattvas, described as being as numerous as the atoms in the universe. And out of this incomprehensibly massive assembly, Manjushu rises to initiate the discourse.
And the text refers to him specifically as Manjushu Kumarahuta. Kumarahuta translates roughly to the youthful Bodhisattva, or the crown prince.
Right.
Manjushu represents the absolute embodiment of supreme wisdom within the Mahayana tradition. His youthfulness signifies that this wisdom is eternally fresh. It's completely untainted by the aging decay of conceptual proliferation.
He doesn't get bogged down in old concepts.
Exactly. So he rises, kneels on his right knee in the traditional Indian posture of supreme respect, joins his palms together, and poses a foundational question. How should followers practice to attain the first Bodhisattva level?
And the term bodhisattva level, or bhumi in Sanskrit, probably requires a precise definition here for you listening. These are distinct, sequential stages of profound realization and capability on the spiritual path that culminates in complete Buddhahood.
Right. The traditional Mahayana path outlines 10 such levels.
Exactly. So Manjushu is asking for the prerequisite conditions. He's asking, how does a practitioner establish that initial footing on this vast trajectory?
And the Buddha's response is entirely anchored in a concept that is translated here as inspiration.
The Tibetan term used is debugs bain pa, right? Translating the Sanskrit ojasta.
Yes, ojasta. And in a colloquial context, you know, inspiration might just mean feeling energized or motivated to do something.
Like getting inspired to write a song.
Right. But within the specific technical vocabulary of this text, ojvasta carries a much heavier valence. It signifies a profound encouragement, a really deep psychological relief, or a literal reviving of the spirit.
Reviving from what, specifically?
Well, more specifically, it connotes being revived from what the Mahayana considers the ultimately complacent goal of individual solitary liberation.
Aye.
It is the specific catalyst that wakes a practitioner up to the vast, universally altruistic path of the great vehicle.
And the Buddha organizes his response using a highly structured pedagogical method here. He delivers his teachings on this inspiration in continuous sets of five principles.
Yeah, it's very methodical.
He states, there are five ways to gain inspiration. What are the five, you may ask? He then details the five, concludes the set, and immediately begins the next set of five.
And this repetitive structure of fives serves a few purposes. Historically, in an oral tradition, it provides a very clear mnemonic framework. It allows practitioners to memorize and internalize these vast amounts of information.
Which was essential before texts were widely written down.
Precisely. But structurally, it creates a rhythmic, almost hypnotic progression of philosophical inquiry. It functions kind of like turning a multifaceted jewel in the light.
I love that image.
Yeah, the practitioner is given time to examine one face, and then the text turns it slightly to reveal the next interconnected facet.
And the methodology the Buddha prescribes for finding this inspiration in the very first set of five is really telling. He states that one finds inspiration by thinking, I will live by a motivation, thereby inspiring others toward that motivation.
It's an interesting phrasing.
It is. And this identical grammatical structure is applied to subsequent virtues. So he says, I will live by trust, thereby inspiring others to trust. I will live by sublime joy, thereby inspiring others towards such joy. The sequence completely demands that the internal realization must precede the external transmission.
It reveals the intrinsic mechanics of altruism within the great vehicle. I mean, fundamentally, you cannot transmit a state of being that you do not fundamentally embody yourself.
Like if we consider the physics of sound, it operates much like a tuning fork. If a bodhisattva wishes to cause the minds of beings around them to resonate at the frequency of trust or joy, they can't accomplish this by merely describing the frequency.
Right, or demanding that others adopt it.
Exactly. You can't just yell at someone to be joyful. The bodhisattva must first strike their own mind, achieving absolute pure resonance with that specific quality. Only by sustaining that pure frequency themselves can the ambient environment, which is the minds of other beings, begin to sympathetically vibrate at that identical frequency of awakening.
The mechanics of sympathetic resonance perfectly illustrate the point here. If a practitioner's internal state is actively vibrating with anxiety or doubt or conceptual grasping, any attempt to teach peace will actually carry the underlying frequency of that anxiety.
The anxiety leaks through.
It always does. The text insists that in the Great Vehicle, the act of self-inspiration and the act of altruism are basically indistinguishable phenomena. They aren't two separate phases of a project.
You don't get peaceful on Tuesday and teach peace on Wednesday.
Right. You embody the Dharma, and the sheer fact of that embodiment is the transmission. You live by the motivation, and your very existence operates as the inspiration for others.
Well, establishing the bodhisattva as the resonant tuning fork provides a really stable foundation. However, the Buddha rapidly shifts from recognizable virtues like joy and trust, and he just wades right into the most complex philosophical assertions of the sutra.
He doesn't hold back.
No, he really doesn't. He begins to instruct the assembly that ultimate inspiration is not found by preferring the good over the bad, but by recognizing the total equality of dualities.
And this is the threshold of the profound view. This is precisely where the linear map we discussed earlier just collapses.
Completely.
The Buddha systematically equates diametrical opposites. He's aggressively dismantling the dualistic clinging that forms the very basis of our ordinary consciousness.
For instance, he delivers a set of five where he equates emptiness sunyata with a viewpoint. He equates nirvat, the final extinguishing of suffering, with samsara, the endless cycle of rebirth.
Which is huge.
And perhaps most jarringly of all, he equates Buddha activity with demonic activity, or the activity of Mara.
And you really have to put yourself in the shoes of the audience here. To a practitioner who has spent decades diligently trying to escape samsara in order to attain nirvana, or striving to suppress destructive demonic mental states in order to cultivate pure Buddha activity,
yeah.
These statements appear completely contradictory. I mean, if not outright heretical.
I mean, I have to push back a bit on behalf of you, the listener, right now. The text explicitly defines demonic activity as any viewpoint that arises due to error, as well as the demonic actions that arise due to such a viewpoint.
Right.
So if error and demonic action are fundamentally equated with the perfect compassionate activity of a Buddha, what is the logical incentive to practice ethics? If the text asserts that the destructive action of a demon is the exact same as the liberating action of Buddha, doesn't it just erase the necessity for any moral framework?
It's the essential question. And to resolve this apparent contradiction, we really must strictly apply the traditional Buddhist distinction between conventional reality and ultimate ontological reality.
Okay, break that down for us.
The Buddha is not suggesting that conventional actions lack conventional consequences. harming a being and saving a being are not conventionally the same. They produce very different karmic results.
Right.
But the text provides the key to its own logic in its statement regarding emptiness. I'll quote it. The Buddha says, "Because emptiness is nothing other than the nature of any viewpoint. Since there is no other nature of viewpoints apart from emptiness, emptiness is the nature of any viewpoint."
So the focus is entirely on the underlying substance of the phenomena, not its temporary conventional manifestation.
Precisely. Consider the classic metallurgical analogy. Imagine a massive block of pure gold.
Here.
A skilled craftsman can melt that gold down and cast it into the shape of a terrifying, wrathful demon with fangs and weapons. That same craftsman can take another block of the exact same gold and cast it into the shape of a serene, perfectly proportioned Buddha in a deep state of meditation. If you look at them conventionally, they are absolute opposites. One form evokes terror, the other evokes deep peace. But if you analyze their ontological nature, if you ask what they actually are, what are you looking at?
In both instances, you are looking exclusively at gold. The shape doesn't alter the fundamental element one bit.
Exactly. And the sutra applies this exact logic to consciousness and action. It states that Buddha activity is inseparable from the nature of demonic activity. The underlying nature of a perfect, universally liberating teaching and the underlying nature of a destructive, confusing, selfish emotion is the exact same unconditioned emptiness.
Junyata.
Both the enlightened thought and the neurotic thought completely lack any inherent, independent, solid existence. They are both as temporary formations of the exact same empty nature.
So recognizing that the demon is composed of gold does not mean the practitioner begins to emulate demonic behavior. The realization is functional then. It liberates the practitioner from the paralyzing fear of the demon.
That's exactly it. As long as you believe the demonic activity, whether it's an external obstacle or an internal neurosis like deep rage, possesses an inherent, solid, permanent evil, your reaction will be entirely dictated by terror, aversion, and aggression. You will attempt to violently destroy it, and in doing so, you become locked in a dualistic war, creating more karma.
You're just fighting shapes of gold.
Perfectly said. But if you observe that rage and recognize its fundamental nature is emptiness, the exact same emptiness that constitutes awakened wisdom, your aversion simply dissolves. You don't feed it, obviously, but you also don't go to war with it. You still maintain flawless ethical conduct in the conventional world, but internally, you are no longer warring against the nature of reality.
And the Buddha extends this logic to other non-dual categories to solidify this understanding. He speaks of finding inspiration by understanding the absence of subtracting and adding, which he paradoxically states is no different from subtracting and adding.
Yeah.
He also instructs the Bodhisattva to understand the absence of acceptance and rejection.
And these teachings really point toward a consciousness that has ceased wrestling with the fluctuating conditions of reality. As long as you fundamentally believe that gaining merit adds something solid to your existence, you'll be plagued by anxiety about acquiring it.
Right.
And as long as you believe that making a mistake fundamentally subtracts from your inherent nature, you will be paralyzed by the fear of loss. When you realize that the ontological nature of both adding and subtracting is pure emptiness, the anxiety evaporates.
You reach a state of profound equilibrium.
Exactly. You are completely free from the compulsion to aggressively accept the pleasant and reject the unpleasant.
To illustrate this profound absence of inherent existence, the Buddha employs a classical motif from Indian logic. He tells the assembly that inspiration is found by understanding the barren woman's child.
This is such a striking image.
He states that the barren woman's child is no different from what is not the barren woman's child, which takes a second to process.
It does. The barren woman's child is a standard epistemological tool used in these texts to demonstrate absolute non-existence. By definition, a woman who is barren cannot conceive or give birth. Therefore, her child does not exist in the past, present, or future.
It's not merely hidden or absent.
Right. It is a conceptual impossibility. And the Buddha utilizes this extreme example to describe the ultimate status of all phenomena. We constantly perceive our own identities, the physical world, and our thoughts as solid and real. But the sutra argues that, upon ultimate analysis, all these phenomena are as unfindable and non-existent as the barren woman's child.
But If a bodhisattva deeply internalizes this view, if they genuinely realize that their own self, the suffering beings they are literally vowing to liberate, and the very path of liberation they're walking, are all ultimately like the child of a barren woman, entirely lacking solid reality.
Yeah.
The immediate risk seems to be total paralysis.
Yes.
I mean, the trap is falling into a state of absolute nihilism. If the building is empty and the people inside it are empty, why bother putting out the fire?
And misinterpreting emptiness as nihilism is considered one of the most dangerous pitfalls on the entire Mahayana path.
Right.
But the sutra actually anticipates this structurally. It immediately transitions from the profound view of ultimate reality straight into the rigorous demands of the bodhisattva's conventional conduct.
It grounds you again.
Exactly. When a bodhisattva genuinely realizes emptiness, the result is never apathy. Instead, because they are no longer bound by the exhausting demands of a solid, self-cherishing ego, their capacity for action expands exponentially.
Because they aren't protecting a self.
Right. They can act entirely for the benefit of others because the boundary between self and other has been recognized as an illusion.
And the text provides a highly specific behavioral roadmap for this expansive action. It outlines what it calls the four ways of magnetizing. This is the methodology a bodhisattva employs to interact socially, actively drawing beings into the sphere of awakening.
And those four ways are generosity, kind speech, meaningful behavior, and practicing what one preaches.
But we really must look at how the text uniquely defines these common terms, because they aren't standard definitions. Whoa. Generosity, for example, is not merely handing over material goods. It is defined here as giving, coupled specifically with dedication.
Yes. The material act is inextricably linked to the dedication of the merit toward the ultimate awakening of the recipient.
Right. And kind speech is defined not just as being polite or nice, but as teaching the Dharma entirely without the hope of reward or personal recognition.
And meaningful behavior is defined fundamentally as the application of love and compassion in every single interaction. And practicing what one preaches is described as the perfect integration of means and knowledge.
Meaning the profound view of emptiness, which is knowledge, must be flawlessly integrated with compassionate action, which is means.
Exactly. And the critical takeaway from these four ways of magnetizing is that they are irreducibly relational. The realization of emptiness does not drive the bodhisattva into some cold isolation. It connects them intimately and infinitely to the surrounding world.
Which transitions perfectly into the sutra's really detailed exploration of discipline, or shila. Because often, when discipline is discussed, it carries this heavy connotation of restriction.
Yeah, it sounds like punishment.
Right. It's framed as a rigid adherence to a list of prohibitions, an ethical straitjacket designed to suppress your natural impulses.
But the Buddha completely redefines discipline here as a vast, expansive state of awareness. He categorizes it into highly nuanced types. For example, he introduces the concept of concealed discipline.
Which sounds mysterious.
Right.
What is concealed discipline?
The text defines it as guarding the senses. In a practical context, this means maintaining a very vigilant awareness over how your mind reacts to visual, auditory, and tactile stimuli. It is the discipline of not allowing the mind to wildly chase after a pleasant sound or violently recoil from an unpleasant sight.
Ah, so it's concealed because it is an entirely internal mechanism.
Exactly. No one watching you can actually see you guarding your senses. You might look like you're just sitting there, but internally, the discipline is incredibly active.
And he then contrasts this with renowned discipline, which he radically defines as engaging in non-dual wisdom. Merely maintaining the view that samsara and nirvana are ultimately equal is classified as a supreme form of ethical discipline.
It's a huge shift from just following rules.
Totally. The Buddha also details discipline free of pride. This specifically targets the psychological dangers of altruism. It means engaging in the monumental task of bringing suffering beings to maturity without ever generating the toxic pride of a savior complex.
Which is so easy to fall into.
It is. If a practitioner thinks, look at how much merit I am generating by saving these ignorant beings, they have completely lost the discipline. Because, referring back to the earlier logic, the bodhisattva must simultaneously know that the beings they are saving are ultimately like the barren woman's child.
The act of saving must be performed flawlessly, but without the egoic inflation of being the savior.
But perhaps the most challenging category for practitioners in daily life is what the text calls gentle discipline. This is defined explicitly as maintaining forbearance in the face of abusive words.
And that is so difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. When a practitioner is verbally attacked, their ego's immediate conditioned response is to generate anger and retaliate. Gentle discipline is the ability to hold one's ground with complete softness, recognizing the emptiness of the aggressor's words, the emptiness of the aggression itself, and crucially, the emptiness of the ego that actually feels insulted.
It's profound.
Yeah.
And this precise mechanism of dealing with hostility leads directly into how the Bodhisattva is instructed to handle their own internal afflictions, their own greed, anger, and ignorance.
Right.
To explain this internal mechanism, the Buddha uses an analogy that just stands out as one of the most striking philosophical images in the entire first half of the sutra.
Yeah, I love this one.
The text states, "Wisdom should not seek after wisdom. Just as the tip of a finger cannot touch itself, wisdom should not seek after wisdom."
It is brilliantly economical. If you raise your hand and isolate your index finger, you can use the tip of that finger to touch a myriad of objects. It can touch the table, it can touch the fabric of your clothing, it can touch your thumb.
But regardless of how much effort you exert,
right,
or how far you contort your hand, the tip of that index finger can never bend back around to touch its own tip.
But how does the physical impossibility of the finger touching itself applied to the psychological reality of dealing with mental afflictions, like deep-seated anger or jealousy?
Well, we had to integrate this with the earlier teaching on non-duality. Remember, the Buddha established that the fundamental nature of an affliction is wisdom.
The underlying substance of the angry demon is the pure gold.
Exactly. When a practitioner feels anger arise, their standard spiritual reflex is to summon their wisdom to attack and eradicate the anger. They treat wisdom and anger as two completely distinct opposing forces.
Like two armies.
Right. The sutra argues that trying to use wisdom to attack an affliction is exactly like the fingertip trying to touch itself. You are artificially splitting the mind into two warring factions, attempting this impossible and deeply frustrating contortion.
So, if attempting to destroy the affliction with wisdom is the wrong approach, what is the instruction? Does the practitioner just succumb to the anger? Do you just act it out?
No, the instruction is to cease the dualistic struggle entirely. You stop trying to make the finger touch itself. True meditative insight does not involve deploying wisdom as a weapon. It involves simply resting your awareness directly on the nature of the affliction itself.
So you look right at it.
You look right at it. You do not feed the anger, obviously, but you also do not violently attempt to repress it. When you look directly into the core of the anger without an agenda, what do you actually find?
You find gold.
You find gold. Because its nature is emptiness, you find nothing solid. You find wisdom. In the very moment of that non-conceptual recognition, the anger loses its structural integrity and just self-liberates.
You completely drop the friction of wrestling with your own mind.
Yeah.
You recognize the gold, and the demon simply melts.
Exactly. And this vast, incredibly dense discourse by the Buddha, this detailed mapping of non-duality, the mechanics of discipline, and the profound instruction on the nature of afflictions, all of this is classified entirely as the preparation required just to enter the first Bodhisattva level.
Which is wild. The sheer scale of that preparation sets the stage for a major narrative and philosophical pivot in the text. Following this vast explanation, the Buddha essentially concludes his discourse and enters a state of deep silence.
He just stops.
He just stops. And Manjushri, ever attuned to the dynamics of the assembly, recognizes that the Buddha's specific transmission on this topic has ended. Consequently, Manjushri shifts his attention away from the Buddha and addresses another paramount figure in the gathering, the great Bodhisattva Samantabhadra.
And this transition from the Buddha to Samantabhadra is structurally vital for us to grasp. Philosophically, it represents the absolute shift from analyzing the cause to attempting to comprehend the result.
Because every principle the Buddha elucidated, the generation of inspiration, the equalization of dualities, the four ways of magnetizing, the fingertip of wisdom, all of these constitute the Bodhisattva's training, right?
Right.
They are the causes, the methodologies, and the perspectives a practitioner must laboriously cultivate over lifetimes. So Manjushri now turns to Samantabhadra to inquire about the inevitable culmination of all that training. He's basically asking, what is the actual lived reality of a fully awakened Buddha? When the path is finally exhausted and complete Buddhahood is achieved, how does that entity function?
And he poses a series of highly technical questions to Samantabhadra. He asks, what is the unimpeded display of the blessed Buddhas like? What is their spontaneous wisdom? How are their bodies unimpeded?
But Samantabhadra doesn't just answer him.
No, rather than immediately launching into an explanation, Samantabhadra hesitates. He actually actively pushes back against Manjushri's request.
He issues this stark warning regarding the nature of the topic. He states, this discourse on the Dharma is difficult to come across, and difficult to comprehend. It is beyond scrutiny. It is not a topic of intellectual study. It is difficult to fathom.
He's essentially cautioning that the reality of a Buddha operates so far beyond the parameters of ordinary conceptual logic that attempting to explain it to an assembly of beings who still rely on concepts might be entirely fruitless.
Or worse, cause confusion.
Exactly. He suggests that comprehending this requires the accumulated merit of having served trillions of Buddhas. Samantabhadra is really highlighting the limits of language here. Language requires a subject and an object, a noun and a verb. A Buddha's reality is entirely non-dual. To describe non-duality using a dualistic tool like language is just inherently problematic.
But Manjushir remains insistent. He counters Samantabhadra's hesitation with a profoundly beautiful and logical argument. He says, while candles may not be visible to the blind, they are visible to the sighted.
It is a brilliant rhetorical maneuver. Samantabhadra is expressing concern that the brilliant light of this ultimate teaching will either blind ordinary beings or be completely invisible to them due to their conceptual obscurations.
And Manjushir concedes that point. He acknowledges that, yes, some beings are metaphorically blind. However, he argues that the existence of blind individuals is not a valid justification for extinguishing the candle for those in the assembly who do possess the capacity to see.
Right.
Furthermore, Manjushir reveals the incredible depth of his motivation. He explicitly states that he is requesting this profound teaching not for the elite scholars, but specifically on behalf of the beings experiencing unimaginable torment in the lower realms, hell beings, animals, and hungry ghosts.
Which is so touching.
He argues that for a being trapped in immense suffering, just the auditory experience of hearing this discourse will act as a profound cause for future liberation, regardless of their current intellectual capacity to grasp its nuances.
And this exchange perfectly encapsulates the radical compassion underlying the Mahayana tradition. You know, in many esoteric traditions, ultimate teachings are fiercely guarded. They're reserved only for a select few initiates who have proven their intellectual and spiritual readiness.
But Manjushir advocates for the exact opposite approach.
He does. He insists that the highest, most incomprehensible truths of reality must be spoken aloud precisely to plant karmic seeds in the minds of the most destitute, suffering beings.
It's an absolute trust in the intrinsic power of the Dharma. The tradition believes the mere echo of a Buddha's ultimate reality carries enough spiritual gravity to eventually alter the karmic trajectory of a being trapped in a lower realm.
And swayed by the absolute compassion of Manjushir's argument, Samantabhadra finally relents. He agrees to open the discourse on the spontaneous, non-conceptual activity of the Buddhas.
But he begins with a core premise that immediately shatters ordinary psychological frameworks. He states that the fundamental defining characteristic of a thus-gone one Tathagata is that their mind is entirely devoid of thoughts, devoid of concepts, and completely devoid of intentions.
To clarify, the text is asserting that a Buddha does not experience the cognitive process of intention.
At all.
At all. A Buddha does not observe a suffering being, formulate the thought, that being is suffering, generate the subsequent thought, I possess the means to alleviate that suffering, and then form the intention, I will now act to save them.
But if a Buddha operates entirely without intention, without a sequential thought process dictating their behavior, how does any action occur? The text simultaneously claims that Buddhas act flawlessly, constantly, and universally to bring all beings to maturity. To an ordinary mind, action without intention implies randomness, or just a chaotic reflex. How does purposeful, liberating action manifest from a state of zero intention?
Because a literal psychological description of this state is beyond scrutiny and impossible to capture in language, Samantabhadra actually shifts his pedagogical strategy here. He abandons direct description entirely.
And moves to metaphors.
Right. He dedicates the remainder of his discourse to a series of elaborate master analogies. And these metaphors are not mere poetic embellishments. They are highly precise instruments designed to point the intellect toward a non-conceptual understanding.
And the first of these master analogies focuses on the properties of a precious jewel.
Yes. Samantabhadra uses the image of a pure beryl gem, which is often conceptualized in Buddhist literature as a wish-fulfilling jewel. He notes that a flawless beryl gem can perform an infinite variety of activities. It can refract light perfectly, it can purify water, and in the mythology of the wish-fulfilling jewel, it can spontaneously grant the desires of beings.
Right.
However, the beryl gem possesses no central nervous system. It has no mind. It never formulates the thought, I will now refract this ray of light, or I will now fulfill this person's wish.
It just exists.
It simply exists. Because it possesses specific perfected qualities like clarity, purity, and density, its activities unfold completely spontaneously and entirely without conceptual intention.
So the analogy suggests that through eons of practicing the exact non-dual discipline we discussed earlier, the Buddha has purified their consciousness to the state of a flawless beryl gem.
Exactly.
They don't need to decide to emanate teachings or compassion. Because they've perfected the qualities of supreme wisdom and boundless compassion, liberating activity simply radiates from them as naturally as light refracting through a prism.
Beautifully put. And the second analogy addresses the mechanism of the Buddha's speech. Samantabhadra uses the metaphor of an echo reverberating within a deep cave.
Okay, an echo.
When various beings enter a cave and shout, the acoustic environment of the cave generates an echo. But the echo itself has no volition. It does not think, this person shouted in Sanskrit, so I must calculate the correct Sanskrit reverberation, or this person shouted in a regional dialect, I must adjust my response.
It doesn't calculate.
No, the physical structure of the cave perfectly and effortlessly returns the exact sound required by the initial input.
And the text applies this directly to the Buddha's pedagogical capability. It says, the thus gone ones are able to dispense their teachings in languages that accord with beings' wishes, non-conceptually and spontaneously.
Yes.
The Buddha acts as the perfect, unconditioned acoustic environment for the suffering cries of the universe. The need of the suffering being is the shout. The precise liberating teaching is the echo. It requires absolutely zero calculation on the part of the cave.
And the third analogy is perhaps the most universally recognized within all of Mahayana literature. It addresses the omnipresence of the Buddha using the imagery of the moon reflecting in water.
Samantabhadra asks the assembly to imagine a clear night sky. There is only one singular moon. Yet, if there are a million separate bowls of pure water placed on the ground, that single orb of the moon will reflect perfectly and completely in every single one of those million bowls simultaneously.
The mechanics of the metaphor are what's crucial here. The moon in the sky never departs from its orbit. It doesn't travel down from the heavens to insert itself into the water.
Right.
Furthermore, the moon does not fracture or divide itself into a million separate fragments to inhabit each bowl. It remains entirely whole, singular, and unmoving in the sky. Yet any individual who looks down into a bowl of still water will perceive the complete moon directly in front of them.
And the sutra maps this directly onto the reality of the Tathagata. It states that the Buddha never departs from the heaven of joy, which represents the ultimate unmoving sphere of reality, the Dharmatattu. Yet sentient beings across infinite world systems perceive the Buddha manifesting directly in front of them, teaching them in their specific language, addressing their specific suffering.
Because the manifestation depends entirely on the capacity of the observer.
Yes. The analogy places the responsibility for perception squarely on the practitioner. The clarity of the moon's reflection is entirely dependent on the condition of the water in the bowl.
And the water represents the practitioner's own stream of consciousness.
Right.
If a practitioner's mind is turbulent, agitated by the winds of anger, greed, or aggressive dualistic concepts, the surface of the water is chaotic. The moon is shining perfectly, but the reflection is shattered and completely invisible.
But if the practitioner applies the non-dual discipline we discussed earlier, calming the afflictions and stilling the waters of the mind, the reflection of the Buddha appears flawlessly.
Exactly. But the Buddha hasn't traveled any distance to arrive in that clear mind. The condition for visibility has simply been met.
You know, to bring this into a modern conceptual framework for you listening, it bears a striking resemblance to how physics describes fundamental forces. Consider gravity.
Okay.
Gravity is not a sentient entity. It doesn't possess a mind, and it certainly does not harbor intentions. It doesn't analyze the solar system and formulate a plan like, I need to exert exactly this much pull on the Earth to keep it at an optimal distance from the sun so that water remains in a liquid state.
Right.
Gravity is simply a fundamental property of mass distorting space-time. Because of its inherent qualities, it organizes the entire chaotic universe into elegant, functioning orbits. Entirely without effort or intention. The Buddha's perfected compassion operates as a cosmic fundamental force.
That analogy holds up exceptionally well. Just as mass distorts space-time to create the gravitational orbits of celestial bodies, the perfected wisdom of a Buddha distorts the fabric of samsara, generating these spontaneous orbits of liberating activity that draw sentient beings toward awakening, all without a single moment of conceptual premeditation.
Samantabhadra employs a final master analogy involving rain to illustrate how a singular truth can produce infinite variations.
He describes a massive rain cloud releasing a deluge. The water falling from the cloud is entirely uniform in its substance. The cloud doesn't harbor prejudice, deciding to rain on a field of crops while intentionally withholding rain from a patch of weeds.
It just rains.
It just rains. It falls equally on all surfaces. However, as that uniform water descends and makes contact with the earth, its manifestation changes based entirely on the receptor. If it lands on a blossoming rose bush, it contributes to a beautiful fragrance and vibrant color. If it lands on a toxic plant, it contributes to the production of poison. If it lands on barren dirt, it just creates mud.
The text makes the application explicit. The Thus Gone One's realm of phenomena is uniform, and yet this realm of phenomena appears differently due to the process of bringing beings to maturity.
It's all about the receptor.
Exactly. The ultimate truth the Buddha emanates is singular and uniform. It is the rain. But when that truth interfaces with the infinite varieties of sentient beings, it is received and processed differently based on their specific karmic readiness and capacities. The teaching adapts seamlessly to the listener without the speaker needing to formulate an adaptation.
And following these analogies, Samantabhadra attempts to actually quantify the scale of this unimpeded knowledge. He states that the Buddha simultaneously knows the exact accumulations of merit, the precise spiritual level, and every single dharan possessed by every sentient being residing in every single atom of every world system across the entire universe.
That's just staggering, and the term koden requires some explanation here. In this context, it refers to powerful mnemonic formulas or incantations that distill vast, complex doctrinal teachings into a condensed sonic form. It allows practitioners to hold immense amounts of spiritual data in their minds.
Right.
So the assertion is that the Buddha possesses instantaneous, non-sequential awareness of the absolute totality of all data in the cosmos.
It is an assertion designed intentionally to overload and break the practitioner's conceptual mind. You cannot calculate that volume of data. You can only surrender to the vastness of the concept.
Which transitions us perfectly into the final major thematic movement of the sutra, the inconceivable scale and the power of merit.
To attempt to illustrate the velocity and scale of the Buddha's awareness, Samantabhadra constructs an image that feels entirely unprecedented. It's almost like a scene from an ancient science fiction epic.
It really is.
He describes a massive body of water, a lake entirely covered in delicate lotus petals, spanning an astonishing 500,000 leagues across.
Upon this vast petal-covered lake, there is a massive chariot constructed entirely of iron. This heavy iron chariot is moving across the surface of the lake at a velocity that is so incomprehensibly fast, the wheels do not even touch the water. Nor do they rustle or damage a single delicate lotus petal on the surface.
And darting around this impossibly fast chariot is a highly venomous snake, moving with such speed that it orbits the chariot in the blink of an eye.
The imagery is just designed to evoke a sense of almost terrifying velocity and precision. Samantabhadra establishes the speed of the circling snake as the baseline unit of time for a series of comparisons.
He states that in the exact microfraction of a second, it takes the venomous snake to orbit the speeding iron chariot. The monk Ananda, who was renowned as the Buddha's personal attendant, possessing an utterly flawless photographic memory, could perfectly recite and teach 10 distinct, complex Dharma topics.
And then the scale escalates. In that exact same infinitesimal fraction of a second, the monk Shoriputra, who represents the absolute pinnacle of analytical wisdom and intellect among the Buddha's early disciples, could teach 1,000 distinct Dharma topics.
The scale jumps again. In that same blink of an eye, the monk Moggallana, who was acknowledged as the supreme master of supernatural powers and miracles, could physically travel through and survey 80,000 entire world systems.
And finally, we reach the apex of the comparison. In that exact same single micro moment, the Buddha engages in a display that transcends time and space entirely. The text states that in the time it takes the snake to circle the chariot, the Buddha demonstrates his entire life trajectory.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. He demonstrates residing in the heaven of joy, his descent and birth in the human realm, his extreme physical austerities, his sitting beneath the Bodhi tree and vanquishing the demonic forces of Mara, his attainment of complete awakening, his turning of the wheel of Dharma, and his final passing into Parinirvana.
And crucially, he does not perform the sequence just once. He demonstrates this entire life cycle simultaneously in all the infinite universes stretching across the 10 directions of space.
The mind simply cannot hold this image. It violently shatters any ordinary linear conception of time and space. Time is no longer a sequence of events. It's a singular, infinitely dense point.
It's all happening right now.
Yes, because the reality the Buddha operates on this incomprehensible vast scale, the text logically concludes that interacting with this reality must generate an equally vast, almost incomprehensible scale of karmic merit.
And Samantabhadra concludes his discourse by meticulously walking the assembly through an escalating hierarchy of merit. This is a classic literary and pedagogical device utilized in Mahayana texts to demonstrate the supreme, unmatched value of engaging with the teachings of ultimate reality.
Yeah.
He establishes a baseline that already sounds impossibly vast. He asks the listener to imagine providing perfect, divine food and every necessary provision to every single sentient being in the entire universe, and sustaining that total generosity for billions of eons.
In the economy of karma, that represents a nearly infinite accumulation of positive merit.
You'd think so.
But Samantabhadra immediately undercuts it. He states that offering a single simple meal to just one layperson who strictly follows the 10 wholesome deeds generates vastly more merit than feeding the entire universe for eons.
And the logic here demands an explanation. How does feeding one ethical person outweigh feeding a universe of ordinary beings? It's because merit is not just about volume, it is about trajectory.
Trajectory.
Right. Feeding ordinary beings sustains their lives within the cycle of samsara. It keeps them comfortable within the illusion. The ethical layperson is actively planting seeds that lead toward liberation from the illusion.
The hierarchy then escalates sharply through the stages of spiritual realization. The merit of feeding that layperson is eclipsed by offering a meal to a stream enterer. A stream enterer, or Srotapanna, is a practitioner who has definitively severed the first three fetters of existence.
They've entered the stream.
Yes, they've entered the gravitational pull of liberation and are guaranteed to achieve awakening within 7 lifetimes. The merit of interacting with a stream enterer is then eclipsed by interacting with a once returner, someone who will only be reborn in the human realm one more time.
And that is eclipsed by the non-returner.
Exactly. Who will never return to the desire realm. That is eclipsed by offering to a fully liberated worthy one, an arhat, who has completely eradicated all afflictive emotions and will achieve nirvata at death. And the merit of interacting with an arhat is finally outshone by interacting with a solitary Buddha, a pratyeka Buddha, who achieves awakening independently without a teacher.
So Samantabhadra builds this towering architecture of astronomical merit only to reach the absolute apex, he asks. What action outshines even the merit of serving a solitary Buddha? What constitutes the ultimate accumulation of good karma in the universe?
The answer the text provides is startling in its simplicity. The ultimate merit is generated by simply seeing a painted image of the Buddha, or even more specifically, by engaging with this very text.
This specific sutra.
Yes. The sutra declares that keeping a written version of this specific teaching, copying it, reciting it aloud, or merely showing it respect by offering a candle or incense, creates incalculably more merit than the baseline of feeding the entire universe for eons.
And to a cynical modern mind, this can easily sound like ancient marketing. It sounds suspiciously self-serving for a text to declare that reading it is the single highest good achievable in the universe.
It does sound a bit convenient.
It does. But we must analyze the structural mechanics of why this claim is being made. It is not hyperbole. It is based on the logic of cause and effect established throughout the sutra.
The reasoning rests on the nature of what the text actually contains. Feeding beings, even for billions of eons, is an act of conventional compassion. It alleviates temporary physical suffering, which is a noble and necessary act.
Absolutely.
However, it does not address the root cause of that suffering, which is the fundamental ignorance of reality. It merely provides a softer environment within the prison of samsara.
Conversely, this specific text contains the direct, unadulterated transmission of the absolute, non-dual reality of the Buddha. It outlines the preparation of equating emptiness with viewpoints, and it transmits the result of spontaneous, non-conceptual activity.
It holds the ultimate view.
Right. Coming into contact with this profound view, even if it is just a momentary intellectual encounter, plants the specific karmic seed that will eventually rupture the illusion of inherent existence entirely. Returning to the prison metaphor, feeding the universe is giving the prisoners a better diet. Engaging with this text is handing them the blueprint to unlock the cell door.
Recognizing the supreme power of this transmission also explains the inverse equation presented at the very end of the sutra. Because the text delivers a severe, almost frightening karmic warning. Just as revering this teaching generates infinite merit, denigrating it generates infinite danger.
And Samantha Padra outlines another hypothetical baseline of extreme action here. He says, imagine an individual who maliciously strikes every single being in the universe, steals every piece of their property, and physically destroys countless sacred jewel stupas.
Which is awful.
Within the Buddhist framework, this represents a staggering, almost unfathomable accumulation of negative karma. It ensures eons of unimaginable suffering in the lowest hell realms.
But the text then delivers the devastating caveat. It states that if an individual were to develop a critical, contemptuous attitude toward the great vehicle, or if they were to become angry and actively deprecate a bodhisattva who is devoted to this specific path, they create an amount of negative karma that renders the previous example mathematically insignificant.
Why is a localized act of intellectual contempt or verbal criticism directed at a bodhisattva considered vastly worse than universal physical mass violence? I mean, it seems wildly disproportionate.
The sutra provides the explicit reasoning for this severity. It states, there is no other dharma besides the bodhisattvas who foster the dharma in others. Bodhisattvas are the dharma.
That phrase, bodhisattvas are the dharma, is the crucial linchpin. Acts of physical violence, terrible as they are, only destroy the temporary physical manifestations of beings within one specific lifetime. Violence terminates a single iteration of a biological life. However, destroying the dharma, which is precisely what occurs when you tear down, deprecate, or silence the bodhisattvas who are actively carrying and transmitting these teachings, destroys the only existing vehicle capable of permanently liberating beings across infinite lifetimes.
You are not just harming a person, you are severing the only lifeline available to the entire universe. You are destroying the medicine that cures the root disease of samsara.
By attacking the carrier of the non-dual teaching, you are actively ensuring that infinite beings will continue to suffer endlessly. Therefore, the karmic weight of that action is absolute.
The trajectory of this teaching has covered an immense, staggering expanse of philosophical and cosmic ground.
It really has. We've journeyed from the pristine Vajra ground of the Buddha's emanated luminous mansion to the dizzying velocity of the iron chariot racing across the Lotus Lake.
We analyzed the Buddha's precise instructions on the necessary preparation for the path. We examined the profound, paradoxical discipline required of the bodhisattva, the radical mind-bending act of equating ultimate emptiness with conventional viewpoints.
Of recognizing that the destructive activity of a demon and the liberating activity of a Buddha share the exact same unconditioned golden nature.
Yes. We internalized the warning that conceptual wisdom must never seek after itself, just as a physical fingertip can never bend back to touch itself.
And we traced how that precise, rigorous training, that exact methodology of letting go of dualistic grasping and warfare, is the direct cause that inevitably ripens into the results Samantha Padra so beautifully described. By training the mind to drop concepts, the practitioner eventually achieves a state where they can act entirely non-conceptually.
They become the barrel gem.
They become the perfectly responsive echo in the cave. They become the single moon effortlessly reflecting in a million bowls of water.
So the ultimate question for any practitioner engaging with a text of this magnitude is one of application. How do you, the listener, integrate a sutra that discusses infinite universes and simultaneous life demonstrations into the immediate reality of your daily practice?
The core invitation of this sutra is a radical call to drop our exhausting dualistic struggles. As practitioners, we expend an enormous amount of psychological energy aggressively utilizing our wisdom to combat our afflictions. We hate our moments of anger. We are deeply anxious about our periods of anxiety, and we feel superior about our moments of clarity.
Exhausting.
It is. This sutra demands that we cease this internal war. It invites us to rest our awareness directly in the non-dual nature of whatever phenomena arise. It asks us to look closely enough at the demon to recognize the gold. If a practitioner can maintain that view, even for a moment, their interactions with the world, their compassionate actions, their generosity, their discipline will cease to be forced, ego-driven projects.
They'll slowly become increasingly spontaneous, unbiased, and universally effective. The text offers us a final, provocative image to hold in our minds. Samantha Padra explained that the activities of the Buddha are ultimately like rain.
Yes, the uniform rain.
The substance of the rain is perfectly uniform and entirely without prejudice. Yet as it falls to the earth, it intimately takes on the specific color, the exact scent, and the unique nature of whatever it touches.
The rain adapts perfectly to the receptor.
Therefore, the question we must continually ask ourselves as practitioners is this.
Yeah.
What is the current scent of our own mind? When the uniform, constant, compassionate reality of the awakened state falls upon the field of our daily life, what specific color does it take on upon contact?
It's a vital question.
If the fully awakened Buddha is already shining as a perfect reflection in the water of our consciousness, how still, how pure, and how free from dualistic turbulence is the water we are providing to receive that reflection?
It is a profound instruction to stop looking outward for the reflection and instead attend entirely to the stillness of your own water. It is an invitation to sit quietly with the immense, unfathomable scale and the already inherent perfection of the awakened state.
It is the ultimate instruction to put down the weapon of conceptualization and to finally stop exerting such immense effort trying to make your fingertip touch itself.
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodhiArchive.org.